Should I read this in like morning radio voice or should I just do my own voice? Hey, CNFers, yeah, you know, I like a good beer or several, and at times, a tasty non-alcoholic beer scratches the itch. If you visit athleticbrewing.com, use the promo code Brendan020 at checkout. You get a nice little discount on your first order. Free Wave and Athletic Light are my favorites. I don't get any money, and they are not a sponsor of the show. I'm just an ambassador, and I like to celebrate this frothy goodness. Oh, and new sponsor. Check this out. Today's podcast is also sponsored by the word anguish. Noun, severe mental or physical pain or suffering. Verb, be extremely distressed about something. That sums it up.
For years along the way, it was a giant stinking mess that the author probably didn't want anyone to see unless they really trusted that person.
Hey, it's the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, a show where I speak primarily to badass writers about the art of telling true stories. I'm Brendan O'Mara. Don't go. Daryl Hartman is our guest today. We recorded this back in November. I know. He's the author of The Battle of Ink and Ice, a sensational story of news barons, North Pole explorers, and the making of modern media. It is published by Viking. He was born and raised in Maine and attended Yale University, where he studied literature. Big ups to Daryl for slumming with a UMass alum. Say what you will about UMass education, but we learned a thing or two about breaking and entering. Show notes to this episode and more are at BrendanOmera.com, where you can also sign up for my monthly Rage Against the Algorithm newsletter. Short riff, 4 books, 7 links. It literally goes up to 11. Writing prompt, CNF and Happy Hour, which I forgot to put the date in for April thing. So if you get the newsletter and you want to attend the CNF and Happy Hour, April 18th, 5 p.m. Pacific time. April 18th, 5 p.m. Pacific. All the shit is in the newsletter to attend. And it's 40 minutes long because I don't pay for a premium Zoom account. Okay, call me cheap. I see you, Melissa. All you gotta do is give me your email address. First of the month, no spam, as far as I can tell. You can't beat it. Okay, but listen, baked into the Rager is cultivating a life in a platform independent of social media, right? I mean, it's kind of my thing. And if I know writers, and I do, we hate promotion and marketing. Just hate it. We just want to write our books and our articles and let the institutions promote it. But that's not how it works, is it? So I'm going to try to make the focus of the newsletter a bit more concentrated on book marketing and like platformy stuff, you know, devoid of social media. I mean, it has to be leveraged to some extent, but you don't have to hang out there like some of the more, irritating people that are on social media. I'll leave it at that. There are several who irritate me in our circle. Guests of this podcast, even. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. Speaking from experience and whatever I might dig up in a month. Newsletter will always be free, but there's also a patreon.com/CNFpod. And you know what's kind of super cool is you get just an incredible discount on this. Depending on your tier, I'm offering like one-on-one office hours. It's a stupid bonkers idea. I'm making it more structured and I'll iron out the details a bit more so it's a bit more concrete. You'll help keep the podcast lights on, but the upper tiers will get some face-to-face time to talk things out. You know, patrons have been digging this additive, and I think it's a little extra zhuzh. It's not just supporting podcast hosting. You're actually, you're getting some very, 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 very discounted FaceTime. All right, parting shot, we'll deal with my personal hell, but first, we're going to hear from Daryl. He's at DW Hartman on Instagram and Twitter, one imagines. X, whatever. And you can learn more about him at darylhartman.com, 2 R's, 2 L's. So let's hear about how the media landscape of the late 19th century kind of echoes today, polar exploration, esoterra, and when you should start sharing your work in progress with a friend. Riff.
Getting to work on a book of my own, I just had this real hankering of, you know, to meet other writers and to talk about it, because writing a book really takes over a lot of your head, and it's a quite solitary pursuit in most ways. So I really just got hungry to meet other people who had done this thing before and talk to them about it.
What were the conversations like as you were looking to commiserate over, you know, the process and just the labor of writing and researching a book?
Yeah, I mean, that does come up. We didn't talk, you know, someone like Reed or some of the other writers I've been meeting lately or reconnecting with, you talk about the work involved. You commiserate about it a bit. I think it's just nice to know that someone else also had to bust their butt. You know, you weren't the only one. And then you get into sort of tactics and techniques, and you want to tell the story of how you found something really cool, and then get into some of the nitty gritty of how you use the archives. In addition to, you know, how you put the book together. I think in that case, it always helps. It helps to have read the other person's book. But I've started really getting into these discussions of structure. How do you put a narrative together? How do you decide what stuff you're putting in and what stuff you're leaving out? I mean, that's another thing I think authors talk about, is the things they wanted to put in there or had in there during the first draft, and then they had to cut. And what was that process like? You know, did you realize you really did need to cut it and it felt good? Were you forced to do it by your editor and you wish you'd been able to keep it in? All these sort of, you know, subjects that have to do with construction. I love talking through that stuff. And I really find you have to be speaking a lot of the times to another writer, because no one else will quite, or an editor. But these are the types of people who want to have those conversations, and you'll get a lot out of it.
Yeah. And writing a book is, I think, at least for me, it's a pretty like ugly process. You know,
yes.
there's just shit everywhere, you know, and oftentimes you like, you lose, even because of the glut of stuff you're pulling in, sometimes you lose sight of things and lose track of things, and you stumble. Like, I try to build in redundancies because I'm just going to keep revisiting transcripts and all sorts of things, because I know I'm going to forget certain things. But as I get more and more familiar with the material and the writing and the rewriting, I'll be like, oh, I didn't put that thing in. I can possibly backfill it. And that's part of the ugliness of my process so far. And I wonder for you, it's because it's so ugly, how did that manifest for you?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying for sure. And I was definitely thinking to myself most of the time I was writing this book, I was thinking, Daryl, you've got to be more organized with your materials. And yeah. I think, you know, talking to other writers, I don't think I was extraordinarily disorganized by any stretch of the imagination, you know, but you're dealing with so much stuff compared to the journalism and the magazine stories I had done before this book. Just it was exponentially larger and that much more to keep track of. And I was always sort of criticizing myself for any time I had to go looking for something for like 10, 15, 20 minutes, that seems hugely wasteful. And I kept just telling myself I was going to improve my process next time. Like I say, I don't know if I was that much more disorganized than a lot of other people. The book got done. I didn't have any huge catastrophes in terms of losing something and never being able to find it.
You really
just have to hold stuff in your head. Like even the best organized person has to hold a lot of thoughts and references in their head. And you do have to leave a lot of that. Just outsource it to your brain. You know, file structure management can only do so much for you.
And there's something to be said about the stuff that you're able to remember over the course of your research is the stuff that's more sticky and is the juice, because you're like, it really glommed on your head and you're right, kind of writing from memory. And then you have to go back, of course, and cite it. But the fact that you remember it means like, oh, that's real good stuff that is likely going to make the cut into the final drafts.
Absolutely. I think you have to trust your instincts. And if your instinct says that's interesting, it probably is. Yeah. And with the sourcing, I one thing I tried to do with this book and did pretty well in the end was anytime I threw a note into some messy like draft document, I kept the source there. And I don't know, Brendan, if you, what program you used to write. I used a program called Scrivener, which made that footnoting a little easier and that organization a little bit easier, because I really did not want that thing to happen where you've got a fact and then you spend hours trying to remember, track down where you got it from.
Yeah, I have Scrivener. I've used it in the past for some essays. But as I was embarking on this current book, I just didn't want to
be kind of concurrently learning a new program when it came to footnoting and sourcing. So I've just been using a giant Google Doc for my manuscript, and just I cite as I write, and just everything I cite, it just drops into a footnote with a Dropbox link to where I have it filed. So a fact checker could hopefully easily just follow that link, and they can, and it should be an easy, relatively easy fact checking lift, but it's a pretty bare bones way I'm doing it. But but I've heard a lot of good things about Scrivener when it comes to this.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm not great at learning software these days, but I feel like I'm only using maybe 15 to 20% of Scrivener's capabilities, but even those are quite helpful. I will say, though, that Dropbox link thing is really smart. I don't do that, and maybe I will. It just like takes one additional step out of the process for that fact checker or for you. I mean, that's what systems are for, right? So that you can be your somewhat disorganized self and creative self, and the system will do some of that organizing work for you.
Yeah, I love that you brought up structure earlier too. And when you were conceiving of this book, how did you initially conceive of its structure, and then maybe how did that evolve as you were reporting and writing it?
Yeah, that's a very germane question for this book. So as I say, so this is my first book. I'd never written a book before. I'd done a decent amount of magazine journalism, but honestly, I'd never done a very long magazine piece even. I'd never done the type of magazine piece where you really play with structure a lot. So this was my first crack at that particular type of challenge. And I really, my first draft, I really kind of overdid it. It was a pretty complex structure. It was quite ambitious. And it basically involved, you know, the book has these two narratives basically about 19th century polar explorers leading up to this 1909 debate over the North Pole, and 19th century newspapers in New York City leading up to this 1909 debate over the North Pole. And we were jumping back and forth a lot between 1909 and earlier periods, and also between polar explorers and newspapers. It was almost like there's a sort of triangular jumping back and forth. I submitted the manuscript with this sort of complex hopscotching structure in place, and my editor quite rightly said, we've got to rethink this because it's just sort of too much going on, leaving too many stories in the middle and going somewhere else and coming back and not being quite sure where we are when we do come back. So basically, I had a pretty massive revise just in terms of the structure. There was a good amount of cutting, but the biggest sort of mental hurdle almost was this restructuring. And we did simplify it so that the back and forth really was more about going back and forth between the newspaper thread and the explorer thread. And we were not jumping, apart for one exception, we're not really jumping back and forth in time the way it was in the first draft. I don't know, maybe I just watched too many Christopher Nolan movies or something. I thought I could pull that off, but it's very hard.
Oh my gosh.
And you don't want to lose the reader. At the end of the day, you're serving the reader. You know, a screenwriter buddy of mine who read the first draft said something really perceptive, I thought. And he said, you've got to the point, this is with the first draft, you've got to the point where this structure is dictating how you tell the story. You want the drama and the emotions to dictate how you tell the story. And that my editor, not in so many words, agreed with that. So here I had at least two people saying kind of the same thing in different ways. And I ended up agreeing with both those comments and felt very good about this sort of laborious change I had to do.
Yeah. Yeah, well, speaking of Christopher Nolan movies, I think the unsung hero of his teams are the people who, the editors who probably help proofread his stuff, because his stuff is so structure driven and more like the structure is the main character in so many of his movies. So it's got to be the idea and the structure. So he's got to have just a titanic team of organizers and editors behind him.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what some of those scripts look like or the movies look like before that team gets involved. I think the takeaway, one big takeaway for me as this, you know, in this book writing experience and including what we're talking about now is, you know, at the end of the day, you go to the bookstore, you buy a book, you see this fairly finished product where everything fits pretty well. What you forget is for years along the way, it was a giant stinking mess that the author probably didn't want anyone to see unless they really trusted that person. And I had to get over that. I had to get over some of that self-consciousness, and I still struggle with this. It's like, you got to be able to show a work in progress that you're not proud of to some trusted people to get their input, because that's how these things get made well.
Yeah, that can be so hard to do, and it's a very vulnerable position to be in, as you know, typically an insecure artist or writer is, and you, it's hard not to take feedback personally. It's hard to just accept or to accept feedback on the work is just for the work itself. It does at times feel like a personal affront, and that's a learned skill, I think.
Yeah, and the tricky thing is it's just you writing for the most part. So anything that people don't like about or think it needs work on, they can't sort of distribute the blame, so to speak. It's all on the author. You can blame the story or the sources or whatever, but it's kind of one person. I mean, now that I think about it, I was involved in documentary filmmaking for a while I was also a writer. I worked with my brother on some stuff, and he had a production company. And I think maybe that was helpful, because with this collaborative process of filmmaking, and it's so technical, right? These different steps and layers that get added, you're always showing messy works in progress. And I remember seeing all these cuts where the director would sort of, before they press the play button, the director gives you all these caveats. It's like, now, this isn't color corrected. It's not the final sound mix. It's a rough cut. This idea of the rough cut. But it's just very standard to show a group of people something that is a rough cut, literally a rough cut. Getting used to that, I think, was helpful. And yes, you can still preamble it with all these caveats, but at the end of the day, you are showing something you're kind of embarrassed about to a group of people, and opening yourself up to their constructive input.
Yeah, there's a fine line between, you know, sharing a work in progress, or the spectrum on which you would share a work in progress. You don't want to do it too early, and you certainly don't want to do it so frequently that you're getting in the way of the generative process. So at what point did you feel comfortable sharing the work in progress, because, you know, you were at maybe a logical stopping point?
That's a good question. I think I was sharing some of it with my wife as we were going, and I think my agent was getting a look at some. I was not sharing a ton, to be honest. That is to say, before I had my manuscript, I did not share a ton. Now, as you probably know, you sell a book like this, a nonfiction book, you've outlined it pretty thoroughly, and you've submitted a chapter or two of sample writing to the publisher. So people had seen things I'd tried out, but a lot of this input and eyeballs and work came after the manuscript was submitted. So that is to say, between draft one and draft two. I think in hindsight, it might have made sense to run some things by people a little earlier, but it was really between draft one and two where a bunch of that work and input happened.
Yeah. And given that you said that you didn't have a whole lot of like super long magazine piece experiences, like likewise, I had the longest piece I've ever probably written on magazine level was probably like 2,500, 3,000 words. So nothing of that super ambitious 5-digit word count thing where you really have to consider the pacing and structure over the long haul, and then you're dropped into the deep end of trying to stick the landing on a 100,000 word book or something. Mm-hmm. So for you, what were some of those growing pains as you were really stretching yourself?
I think the biggest one was getting stuck in digressions. I mean, I'm in your boat. I really hadn't written any magazine stuff more than 3,000, 3,500 words. And I also hadn't done a ton of history, to be honest. And I found this research so engrossing and fascinating, and I just wanted to share what I had learned, that along the way of writing, I kept sort of veering away from the narrative to doing these sub-narratives and like character profiles of people who really weren't that essential to the story. And, you know, not having worked with the structure before, I didn't realize while I was doing that how distracting that was to a reader. You know, well, I'm like, well, this will be interesting because it's just inherently interesting, even if it doesn't relate to this main thread of the narrative too much. And it turns out that's wrong, I think, from a storytelling perspective. So I really had to trim that stuff back and hew to the main thread of the story a lot more. I would say that was the biggest thing, if I had to name one. I already was juggling two kind of main threads. Like I said, there's this newspaper world, and there's this world of explorers, and you can't just be going down little alleyways within those worlds. You have to keep pretty close to them so that they can interact in a way that makes it just is more propulsive, right? Keeps the story moving ahead to this climax that you've got in mind, which in this case was this big 1909 controversy when everything sort of hits a boiling point.
Mm. Yeah, and given that you grew up in Maine and New England, I grew up in southeastern Massachusetts, and I have and we're about the same age, so I have a love affair with the Boston Globe and those just giant Sunday globes, and you know, my dad peeling off, giving me the comics and whatever. I have a very big soft spot in my heart for like actual newspapers. So like for you, what is your relationship to newspapers, you know, in that sense?
That's a great question. You know, I grew up in a very small town in Maine. We did not have, you know, the Boston Globe. You would get it in Maine, but I did not grow up reading that paper. The Portland Press Herald was the sort of Maine newspaper. The Kennebec Journal was my local paper. I remember them being around and reading them, but personally, I didn't have a huge connection, I wouldn't say, to newspapers. On the other hand, my mom wrote for newspapers. My mother was a journalist most of her life and wrote for smaller papers. I guess it's more this idea of media, right? So in this the period in which this book is set, newspapers are media. That's one of the points. There's a few magazines out there, but there's no radio, there's no television, there's no internet. When you say media in the 1800s, we're mostly talking about newspapers. So I would say my connection to the media is much more pronounced. Growing up, but also as an adult, you know, I've been I wrote for 2 years for a glossy monthly magazine and then went freelance in 2007. And so for years, I've just been writing for all kinds of different media and specifically in New York City. So to me, this idea that New York City is kind of the center of this media universe is something that I've lived with for a while. And it was really fun to explore the origins of that in the historical sense. And, look at the origin, the genesis of these newspapers and just how powerful they came to be and how essential a piece of the New York City fabric they were. You know, this idea that New York City is the center of so many things, like news as much as anything, drives that point home. You have an entire nation getting a lot of its foreign news and other forms of news and entertainment from these New York City papers, including the giant Sunday papers. So all that was really fun to look into. In terms of my personal experience, I was never really a news reporter, a beat reporter so much. Mm-hmm. So I don't have that sort of ink-stained wretch newsroom kind of background myself. But certainly it's a colorful world to research and to read about.
Yeah, there's a moment earlier in the book too where you write, as Collier's noted in a series of newspaper business 15 years later, Goddard's guiding principle was, quote, economy of attention. It worked like a charm, sending circulation of the Sunday World beyond 500,000. And I dog-eared that section because so much of what we deal with today is this economy of attention just being bombarded, be it social media or whatever clickbaity type things are out there. And so like in a sense, what did you notice that resonated or echoed to our current day from, you know, the 1800s?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what concerns us about social media right now, legitimately, I think, concerned a lot of people 120 years ago. The only difference was they were focused on the newspapers. You know, a lot of people thought newspapers were evolving in a dangerous way, too much, too fast, too sensationalized, the lack of expert authority, falsehoods everywhere. On the one hand, I realize, you know, a lot of our concerns aren't new, but I don't want to trivialize our concerns by saying they're exactly the same as we've always said. I think you've got to sort of thread the needle between those points. It actually gave me some interesting perspective on the media environment of today, which I think is not at its best. But there have been other periods when people have been very concerned, and there's been a lot of disruption and chaos when it comes to the media landscape and how we get our news. This was an era, so Goddard and Brisbane and those Sunday World, that world that you just sort of referenced, that was becoming a big thing in the 1890s. And that was a period when newspapers were enormous, overstuffed forms of information and entertainment. They were very cheap. They were actually cheaper than the paper they were printed on. The publishers, however, made great amounts of money just because of the advertising that those newspapers were generating, and the advertising profits were getting huge. In fact, you had this new, it was really a new model of making money off of newspapers, which was advertising, which is would come to define media for decades thereafter. So learning all this stuff, and again, sort of seeing how we got to be in the media environment we're in today, I thought that was great. And there was a lot of yelling. You know, this was the, I think one of the complaints of the time was that newspapers had formerly been a bit more moderate and quieter and thoughtful, and they'd taken the longer view on things. And what you had in this 1890s was a new world in which newspapers got sensational and started getting very emotional, and they were kind of yelling the news rather than talking the news. Not everyone loved that. So that story has many sides to it. You know, these newspapers were popular. They engaged people who hadn't been engaged before by the newspapers. They weren't just for elites to the degree that newspapers had been for the elites before. I do see a lot of echoes in terms of now how social media has disrupted traditional media or legacy media. But I don't know. I think social media has done a lot of damage personally. So to me, it feels to me like a more pressing problem now.
And with the rise of AI and not being able to, or being very hard to discern what is, you know, what is real, what is fabricated, what has been airbrushed to the extent that something fake looks totally real. I don't know how we develop a greater sense of media literacy. I don't know. Maybe you can speak to that, just given the world you are in, because there was a lot of sensationalizing and fabrication, and people had to learn how to comb through that in the 19th century, early 20th century too.
Yeah. Well, and this topic is where I do see some hope. You know, this world of hysterical fake news where the papers are just sort of making stuff up hit its fever pitch around 1898, 1899. And I go over this in the book a bit, where the U.S. was at war in Cuba, and the events leading up to the war in Cuba with the Spanish. You know, this was the war that Mr. Hearst, you know, William Randolph Hearst, the publisher of the Journal, was said to have created this war. It's a bit of an exaggeration, but it tells you how powerful he was thought to have been. And the idea that a newspaper publisher could have, in fact, started a war between the U.S. and a foreign power had some credibility back then. After that, there was a kind of turnaround. It had to do for, you know, there were business reasons behind that, but I think there was also a cultural fatigue with this type of sensationalized and untrustworthy news reporting. And it's out of that fatigue that I think the New York Times was able to chart a new path around this time. And the New York Times is one of the main characters of this book, if you will, and its publisher, Adolf Ox, who was very intent on kind of going against the tide of sensationalism and having a newspaper that reported just the facts, was comprehensive, reliable, and unbiased, right? That was a big part of it, was that the Times should be seen as an impartial and therefore trustworthy paper for a certain type of reader. The other thing that happened, you know, the Times is actually ahead of the curve on this, because a little bit after this time, I would say approaching 1910, the industry really put in a bunch of new measures and safeguards. This was necessary, you know, because prior to this time, there was no real check on falsehoods and fake news. The market sort of had to govern itself. What was keeping a newspaper from publishing utter rot? It was basically the scrutiny of other newspapers. So it was kind of a self-policing world, which worked to a degree, but it was really insufficient in a lot of ways. So what you had happening right around the time my story ends was this new set of ethical standards, a new type of professionalization in the news, a much stricter attitude among the respectable papers, at least when it came to advertising. We sort of forget about advertising, but there's a lot of bogus stuff being advertised and crazy claims being made for things like granola and breakfast cereals and patent medicines that would never pass muster today, unless you're deep in the nether regions of like midnight cable television or something, you know what I mean? So the industry did sort of start to reform. And I think we're about at a point now, in my opinion, where some kind of reforms and regulations are necessary, whether that's enforced by the government, which it was to a degree back then, but also the industry itself. And I say the industry, I mean social media more than media personally.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it is. It's been encouraging for, you know, organizations like NPR who pulled out of Twitter altogether, and they didn't notice like really any drop off in their traffic and everything. And I think that's an example. A lot of us who have been hoodwinked into thinking we need that stuff for platform building, we're like, oh, okay. You know, if they can pull out and still be fine, and they are skiing on their reputation, it's like, okay, maybe we can do a better job of just building a better body of work and reputation on our own, and then we can eschew social media altogether and get out of that morass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I sound like an old fogey, but I'm pretty into the idea of banning TikTok. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for me to go into that, and I don't know enough, honestly, but like on a gut level, that feels like the type of strong step. We're in a world where a lot of things are being manipulated by foreign powers. I wouldn't be sad to see that happen.
Yeah, and I was, for about 3 years here in Eugene, I was the editor of the opinion page of what was left of it. When I had started, we were still doing editorials and stuff. And then when the paper merged with Gannett, you know, Gannett has a way of wiping out editorial pages, and on the basis that they think that their readers don't want to be preached at, but it's just patently foolish. But there's a moment in the book too where you write or cite that the discontinuing of editorials in newspapers makes journalism more of a business than a profession, and that really resonated and hit home with me as an opinion page editor. You know, people liked having opinions that sparked dialogue instead of taking it back and like worrying about offending your readership, or, you know, sometimes they needed to be challenged and they liked to be challenged. And this idea of it was just pandering to the lowest common denominator to eradicate the editorial page and opinion content and letters to the editor. And so that, you know, that moment in the book really resonated with me because I had a finger on the pulse of that fall from grace, really.
Yeah, and that's really, those are some of the two biggest currents, right, in journalism in the history of media, and the book covers that a bit. This idea that the newspaper is a community thing that serves its readers, and the idea that a newspaper is a business that serves its advertisers. I mean, I'm simplifying here, but these are kind of the different poles.
Yeah.
And early on in American history, I talk about the origins of the New York Herald. That paper succeeded hugely in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s because it was serving its readers. You know, the editor of that paper, the publisher, James Gordon Bennett Sr., never shied away from a fight or an argument. He probably went too far. He loved it too much. Always stirring up trouble. You know, if advertisers complained about this, he'd tell them to go to hell. You know, I've got more readers than anyone. People read my paper. This is the way I do it. So that's a current in independent journalism and how it is done. By the same token, you know, the 1890s into the early 1900s, newspapers were really becoming corporate for the first time and consolidated. You were starting to have some mergers, and the advertising model had started to reign supreme. So it's under this advertising model that the publishers get very wary of publishing anything that is going to offend advertisers, really. My understanding is the reason they shied away from conflict was not because they were too worried about offending readers, but because they didn't want to stir up trouble among their advertisers and lose those advertising dollars, which is just a business focus. So newspapers, you know, do need to make money, but what are the priorities here? That's sort of one of the tensions that's constantly at play.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about the journalism and the newspaper ecosystem at the time, but there's also the other major spur of your book, which is the polar exploration part with and the dueling paths of Frederick Cook and Robert Peary. So I just speak to them in polar exploration and the rivalry that ensued.
Sure. Yeah. So in the way that the media story of this book felt very contemporary and relevant to me, it's so much overlap with the day we currently live in. I thought the Polar Explorer element had a nice throwback feel. We don't really have this anymore, this idea of people, you know, men mostly at the time, almost exclusively, throwing on their furs and getting their dog sleds and trying to perform these huge feats into places that people have never been before. But of course, that was happening at the time. It was one reason these explorers truly were celebrities, and among some of the most famous Americans and Europeans were polar explorers. You know, it's a pre-Hollywood time, so the definition of celebrity was very different back then. And these were very inspiring figures that took huge risks and reaped huge rewards. The interesting thing about the North Pole controversy, it's really the period when that heroic image of the polar explorer took a huge beating, because they were considered these sort of stoic men of honor. They were expected to behave a certain way. And with this North Pole controversy of 1909, they behaved not that way at all. You know, there's a lot of name calling and accusations of fraud, and the sort of financial incentive that goes into exploring, the profits that can be made out of it, became front and center during this whole debate. So I really see it as kind of a turning point where we lost our innocence about these explorers and what they do. So I found that whole thing irresistible. That story, this fascinating, fiery chapter in American history that had never been told with this media perspective before. So how does the media fit into this huge controversy between Frederick Cook and Robert Peary, both of whom claimed to have reached the North Pole, right? And then Peary accused Cook of lying. The media factors into the story because each of these explorers had a powerful New York City newspaper backing it. And the ability of these newspapers to be impartial was, of course, severely tested because they each had a horse in the race. So It's this kind of partisan media moment. That group of factors made me hugely interested in telling this story. And like I say, this idea of partisan media and really Cook and Peary appealed to different parts of the American character and the way the American populace really came down on either side of this debate echoes very loudly today with these sort of geographical, political, cultural identity divisions that are sort of tearing America right now. Again, I think social media has made it even worse unnecessarily, but a lot of those fault lines were also in existence 120 years ago, and you really see them play out during this sort of headline controversy that was going on.
What was it about either Cook or Peary that was so divisive and got different areas of the country like rallying around one versus the other?
Yeah, that's a key question. You know, honestly, during this 3-month period in the fall of 1909, really the dividing figure was just Robert Peary. Frederick Cook came back from the polar regions first. He first claimed to have reached the pole, and he was celebrated around the world, and he was a very popular figure. He seemed like the underdog. He'd done this purported achievement on the cheap. He hadn't needed to spend a lot of money. He had a simple background. He didn't have powerful friends in Washington or any of these sort of millionaire businessmen that were funding Robert Peary. So Frederick Cook honestly was a folk hero for a while. The problem was that Robert Peary and other people suspected he was lying. He was a con man, essentially. And this news was not received well by the American public. To a person, they almost all rejected this as sour grapes on Robert Peary's part. Because Cook's reputation had, even just in a few days, coming back, this great American hero, he's discovered the North Pole for America. America has won this kind of polar race that's been going on for decades. People don't want to dislike or question Frederick Cook. They're kind of in his camp. So Robert Peary's accusations do not go over very well. There's also the manner in which Peary makes them. He's a very blunt, angry guy. He's not a very likable personality, which I think is just obviously a timeless thing that's not going to go over well. But then you have to look at his context, his sort of social context. He was funded by mostly New York City millionaires of the period. He pulled a lot of powerful strings. He was seen as the establishment explorer. He was a Navy man, and he had a lot of resources because he tirelessly sort of cultivated those resources. So the very easy divide you have is the sort of the underdog, the everyman underdog in Frederick Cook, and the sort of strategic, cunning establishment guy in Robert Peary with his powerful friends. And this was a very potent way of, you know, contrast in these two explorers. And the point is that this contrast in the explorers and their sort of contrasting characters was much more the story for a while than the facts of the matter regarding whether either one had been there. And I look into this, I think there's a lot of interesting human reasons for this, but people just love an argument, and personalities are more compelling, for better or worse, than facts are. And this was gold if you were a newspaper editor. You know, watching these two guys have this sort of unprecedented type of explorers fight, this was generating headlines on a daily basis. You know, it was sort of complicated for the New York Times and the New York Herald because they were stood to win or lose money or win or lose prestige based on how this thing turned out. But for all the other newspapers commenting on it, it was just sort of, they were sort of having a field day, because every day someone would make some new accusation or some new evidence would emerge and you could talk about it. So sort of a classic type of news story where the science gets pushed to the side and we can just have this long barroom conversation about who's the better man and who made it and who didn't. That's what America was doing.
And with an explorer making that mission to try to get to the pole, what are the kind of notes that they need to take, and how does it, or what are the difficulties in verifying how far they get?
Right. So with any explorer of this period, you are expected to provide documentation of where you've been. You're expected to have some corroborating witnesses. But a lot of this is considered sort of an afterthought, to be looked over by scientific authorities after you've made the announcement. This is not what happened in the case of Cook and Peary. Cook came back and it was unclear what kind of documentation he had. And then Robert Peary coming back and claiming that Cook has invented the whole thing suddenly put a huge spotlight on this idea of documentation. You know, oh, well, what evidence should a person like this bring back, and what does it all mean? And this happened in the context of the North Pole, which is uniquely hard to navigate to and uniquely hard to prove that you've been to. This would not be an issue, for example, 2 years later when Roald Amundsen discovered the South Pole, which is a fixed point on Earth. You know, you go to the South Pole, you leave something there, it will stay there, which is exactly what Amundsen did. So when Robert Falcon Scott got to the pole several weeks after Amundsen, he saw the things that Amundsen had left behind. At the North Pole, this is really just a notional point atop drifting sea ice. So if you were to leave something there, it would float away. So you can't leave something there proving you've been to the pole for the next person who comes. And the very task of getting there is incredibly hard because you have these polar currents moving in kind of a gyration pattern. You've got to use a sextant, a compass, all these other navigational instruments to figure out where you're going and make sure that you truly are on a pure north course, despite these currents. So you need at least a couple competent navigators to pull this off. And really the thing that tells you you've been to the pole is these instruments you've brought with you, which require a lot of knowledge, you know, navigational knowledge, knowledge of the stars, astronomy. Of course, you're very cold. You need a clear day to take some of these astronomical observations. You need the weather to cooperate, which it does not always do in the Arctic. So I don't think the public truly understood just how difficult it is to pull off these navigations and record them appropriately. And the public, to a degree, started to get an education in this. But it's another reason it was kind of a turning point in exploration, because it really started to get into the nitty-gritty of navigating and proving you have done something in a way that had never had to happen before, because there was never a controversy to this degree. You had a very complex matter being summarized in often simple terms, which is tricky. And the scientific authorities were not really weighing in with any useful information or direct information, because both Cook and Peary were, for different reasons, withholding their evidence. So it's kind of their fault that it became this uninformed, this whole debate. You know, I would read the book to sort of try to understand why they were withholding their evidence. It's complicated. But the media is basically asked to do a very difficult job of trying to litigate this dispute, which is best decided by science.
Yeah, you took my next question right out of my mouth of why they would withhold evidence if it would, in fact, prove or disprove where they were.
Yeah, I think the short answer is the evidence was not rock solid, and it would be risky for the explorers to truly put it out there. You know, Robert Peary had his travel log and his readings validated by a scientific body with whom he was very cozy and friendly. But apart from getting sort of a yes, we believe him, the public wasn't really privy to what that scientific body had looked at or what questions they had asked him or not asked him. So all the stuff about Peary basically succeeding behind closed doors happens once again and just kind of reinforces this idea of Robert Peary, for one, being the sort of master of the cigar-filled room, you know, where he's got his fellow powerful men there just sort of making sure he succeeds. That's the way he went about getting his claim validated. It wasn't by making everything available to the public. It was this very closed door type of thing, which later on, you know, this story kind of ends in 1909, but not really. So it would take years for people to go into archives and try to dig up information about Peary's own records and what he had done or not done.
And did this lead to a greater sense of transparency when it came to exploration of this nature?
You would think it would. I'm less an expert on the subsequent periods. Honestly, I think there's some incidents that happened later on that suggest it really didn't change things as much as you would think it would. I do think nowadays it would be next to impossible to pull off something like this just because the technology makes it much easier to communicate where you're going and to have where you've gone be validated. You know, obviously we navigate using satellites and you can live stream things almost no matter where you are. This is from a period when you could go off the map for months and years at a time and have no way of getting in touch with anyone. So I think the technology was different and the standards were a little different back then.
Yeah, and you talk about corroborative witnesses, and at times a lot of these Eurocentric white explorers, they would have the help of indigenous and native cultures, and yeah, who could really speak to the landscape and how far they got. But the racism being what it was, they were not considered trustworthy witnesses.
They were dismissed on racial grounds, but I don't think that's the whole story, to be honest. Mm-hmm. The truth is, this idea of going many, many days beyond land and onto the frozen Arctic Ocean, that was a white man's idea. So at a certain point, you're going beyond the geographical knowledge of these native peoples, and it really does become about the instruments. And the Inuit did not have they had many, many skills that white men like Robert Peary made use of, but using a sextant was not one of them. Mm-hmm. So it is truly the sort of complex, almost theoretical place that you're going to. And to go there without use of the instruments is just kind of meaningless in terms of how far north you went, because you can just be walking in circles and you wouldn't know it.
And what ends up being the fallout of this dispute to the two men at the center of it?
As I said, the story kind of ends, there's like a false ending in 1909-1910. Frederick Cook is disgraced and Robert Peary is not. That's not the whole story. I'll leave it at that because I don't want to give too much away. There was, you know, this dispute did damage the field of exploring. It's hard to put a finger just on how much it did that, especially in America, right? This was an American controversy. It was an American embarrassment. It did damage a prospective American attempt to reach the South Pole first. In fact, Robert Peary wanted to endorse an American South Pole expedition. The skipper of his vessel, the Roosevelt, Bob Bartlett, wanted to lead the expedition. And the National Geographic Society tried to raise money for an American attempt on the South Pole and did not succeed. And one of the reasons for that was because the American public was so disgusted with Robert Peary and the way he had behaved during this controversy, that they really were not willing to open their pockets and donate to this. In the end, I don't know if that would have achieved a whole lot, because Amundsen and Scott were pretty quick on the draw and got there, and you had two men who reached the South Pole pretty quickly after this. But for a period at least, there was a sense of disgust among the American public in how these explorers had behaved. And it did sort of put a damper on that for a while. And then, of course, you had World War I, during which most exploration of all kinds stopped anyway. But I do think there was a kind of residue of this controversy that lasted for a while, you know. It was not a shining moment for America or America's explorers. And if you were a Peary fan, you saw it as evidence of sort of how gullible the American public was to a likable con man like Frederick Cook. That was the perspective of people in Peary's camp. But even if you were a Peary fan, you sort of had to admit he'd behaved quite badly. And this did not reflect well on the exploring community, this whole thing.
Do you think that, let's see, nowadays, let's say, I don't know, interstellar exploration is like the new polar frontier? Is that where we're going with, you know, American oligarchs and social media and trying to push the bounds of what's excitable to the public who wants to see our boundaries get stretched?
I think so. I think that's the closest analogy. I think, the other analogy that's made is the space race of the 60s, mm-hmm. Which might be more accurate just because you think of how public and popular that space race was. I think today's space stuff still feels kind of niche, weirdly. Maybe this is just me. I'm not personally that interested in it, but I think it's, you know, it feels dramatic because it's connected to Elon Musk or something. You know, the pursuit itself and the exploration itself doesn't get people excited, or the majority of people excited, in quite the same way. I think there's a sense that I don't know who the heroes of this thing are. You know, so on a symbolic level, I think one of the reasons exploring is so compelling and was so compelling is because you have individuals who pull off incredible feats of daring and intelligence. I think that was as true in the 19th century polar world as it was during the high point of NASA, you know, the Apollo missions and all that. These were national heroes. Everyone knew their name. They said a lot about us as a country, who we wanted to be as a country. Hollywood movies were made about them. I look at the way space stuff is going today, it doesn't seem to be quite the same. I guess if I had to name one major difference, it seems like so much of it is done by robots. You know, we've got to a point where we can achieve things without putting human lives in danger to the same extent, which mm-hmm. is probably good overall. At the same time, I think these things take on a monumental significance when there is a type of risk involved, and we're now averting that type of risk. So when it comes to myth making and huge figures, I don't know if we're going to be able to do that in quite the same way, or at least the way it is now. If we start colonizing and some of the first pioneers head out, that could change. But when I look at the space race landscape now, I don't see the same type of larger than life figures and larger than life conflicts. It's really about the owners who are sitting in big boardrooms making decisions, but I don't think that's as inherently dramatic as the actual going out there, crossing the frontier yourself and coming back and reporting on what you found.
Well, very nice. Well, Daryl, as I like to bring these conversations down for a landing, I always ask the guest for a recommendation for the listeners out there, just something fun and exciting that you're excited about. So I just extend that to you as we bring our conversation to a close.
Sure. Well, I was going to say Scrivener, but we already talked about that. So I, 2 years ago, finally discovered the Patrick O'Brien novels. So this is the guy who wrote Master and Commander and something like 19 other historical seafaring novels. And they're absolutely wonderful. And I am not a sailor, despite the fact that I grew up in Maine, pretty close to the ocean. I really don't know the first thing about sailing, let alone the Napoleon-era British Navy. But I cannot recommend these books enough. And in fact, I'm sort of pacing them out. There's, like I said, there's about 20 of them. And so my life plan is to read, on average, one a year for the next 20 years, just to sort of keep myself to the way you would with a tasty dessert, you know, because there's the language is so incredible, the detail is so incredible, the spirit of adventure and bonhomie among these sort of sailors is just so beautifully captured by Patrick O'Brien. So that's the thing I'd recommend.
Oh, fantastic. Well, this is awesome, Daryl. The book is such a wonderful conflation of these of that era at the time. And it was so cool to see you like sort of harmoniously braid those seemingly disparate industries together. So it was a really great read in that sense. So just thanks for the work and thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Brendan.
All right. Well, thanks to Daryl for coming on the show. Thanks for your patience, Daryl, seeing as this took 6 months to hit the airwaves. Has been in the can for a long time, and thanks to Anguish for the support. Never without you. On the day this podcast dropped, April 5th, that leaves your panicky, sweaty, altogether unattractive, somewhat fleshy podcast host with 10 days before deadline. I've cut, as of this writing, 37,000 words from the book. I'm a little more than halfway through the third pass. This last pass is me taking a fucking flamethrower to this book and just burning it to the ground. You know, some combination of Beetlejuice and the Joker, just pure anarchy. There's got to be a better way, but maybe not. You know, at first, the first pass through was like, you know, trimming everything editor suggested and some little things. And the second pass through was like, okay, some obvious things to cut. Now, this time it's just like brutality. Brutality. My great worry, as I try to at minimum cut another 10 to 11,000 words from this thing, is that areas are starting to read too thin or superficial, or like you're just skating over the surface. Like this feels like a grocery list or something. Yeah, is this scene or chapter really boring, or am I just bored with it because I've read it 6,000 times? I have to really interrogate these scenes. Like, what work are they doing? You know, and there's no scene union. You're not going to unionize and go on strike. You answer to me, fucker. This past week, I've had a 4,000-word and 5,600-word cut days. Any deviation from my main guy, even cool things with my main guy. It's like, sorry, you gotta go. I still have to write a prologue, but that'll only take me a couple hours, like 1,000 words or so. I've used this metaphor before, and I hope this is what's happening, is when you reduce a sauce, you're cooking out the water to concentrate the flavor. And if you're a messy home cook, you know that the sauce puts up a fucking fight. There's steaming hot bubbles exploding all over the stovetop. Shit's getting all over your apron and your skin, and you're screaming and cursing at the crushed tomatoes who are like spitting up on you, like, fuck you, tomato, and the walls, and it's getting all over your dignity. Eventually things simmer and you're left with a thicker, memorable sauce at half the volume. So that's book writing. Stay wild, CNFers. If you can't do interview, see ya.